Okay. So, it's the... What date did we say it was? The 18th. The 18th of November.
Yes.
2014.
Yes.
And we're sitting with Mr. Robert William Copeland, who's very kindly agreed that we can call him Bob. And we're going to ask you, Bob, a few questions about yourself and then anything interesting that you've got to tell us about Cartmel.
Yeah.
So first off, can I just ask you to tell us when you were born and where you were born?
I was born in Fleet, in it's Holland or Lincolnshire. And it's a very agricultural place all around there. And then I was, after that, my mother left my dad because they were in the Air Force together. I've got some photographs from and she couldn't either get on with him or somebody or other. But I never inquired at all, ever in my life, what went on between them, because that was between them. Anyway, and so what do you think she did? Next door neighbours, I've got a photograph actually of the house next door, because I went on my holidays about 7 or 8 years ago, and to see that, I showed my daughter the house that, although I left there when I was about 3.5, 4 I would be when I left there, and when I got there, the house next door, I have a photograph, and she took a photograph in front of the house, but the house that I lived in was next door, and I always remember it had what I always call a Father Christmas chimney, those big round chimneys. It had all gone.
Right.
It was a brand new house built there.
So tell us when you were born, Bob.
The 3rd of December 1919.
3rd of December 1919,
yes,
okay.
I am now, in another 3rd of December, I shall be 54. 54, yes.
You'll be a little bit older than 54.
Well, 55, is it? 55, yes, that's right. I'm losing track of time, aren't I? Anyway, there's an excuse for me.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
No. So, what she did, she went next door, and there were a coal merchant, and she borrowed the barrow from next door, it was one of these with the handles on and just two wheels, and she got the case, well, it wasn't a case, it was a trunk with a black one. And I remember all this with a round top to it. You see, in those days, when girls and that went out to service, the fathers, if they could do, would buy them a trunk to put all the things in, you see, because they'd be away. And her dad, my granddad, he must have bought this for her. Anyway, she struggled and got this on this barrow, and got me all dressed up and put a ticket on me, and she took me to the local station, which is all gone through Beeching, of course, at Fleet. The Fleet station is gone now. Put a ticket on me and then put me on the train to the guard. And this is how far she sent me. I mean, imagine this day and age. I went all the way through to Gainsborough. Now I had to go from that station through to Doncaster, I think it was, or somewhere like that, and be transferred to another train and then go to Gainsborough. And at the same time, she sent a telegram to her sisters at Gainsborough to say that she's put me on the train. She must have inquired about the times and everything like that. And they'd be there waiting for me, see. So there I was going on this train, all this journey on my own with this black trunk. And when I got to Gainsborough, the station is still there, there was a horse and cab in those days, with the driver on the top, and me two aunties, of course, my mum's sisters, younger sisters, were waiting there for me. And they took me to number 3 Campbell Street in Gainsborough. And I've been back since, and of course, that's still there, of course.
And how did you end up in Cartmel?
And so then, of course, I was with my granddad for about 3 or 4 years, say 3 years, around about 7, I think, something like that. You see, and I kept saying to her, when's my mum coming, when's my mum coming, you see. I can remember doing that. And then, of course, she eventually did come for me. And, of course, she went, she married, well, she didn't marry him then and there. She her cousin it was, that she, in other words, my stepfather, he was, you see, eventually. And to Cartmel, of course. And we lived in Priest Lane.
So what was the connection with Cartmel that they had?
Well, because the whole family lived there, you see. He lived there, my stepfather lived there, and his mother, because after I'd been there about a year, I remember going to her funeral. I've got photographs of that, of being down at Humphrey Head. And then, of course, we were in this little cottage, and it was separated from the next cottage. It must have fell down, something like that. But when I actually arrived there, he was out of work.
Sorry, Bob, are you in Cartmel now?
Yeah, I'm in Cartmel now.
Cartmel.
And on Ainsham Road, you know where the steps are, they go over Hampsfell?
Yeah.
What do you call it, the road there?
Ainsham
Road.
Yeah.
Right opposite there was a little cottage next to the house itself. That's called Enneric House. But the cottage isn't there now because someone bought it and bought the cottage and incorporated it in the house. There's a big garage there, a double garage.
So how old would you have been when you moved to Cartmel?
About seven.
And you moved to the house in Priest Lane?
In Priest Lane, right opposite the old police station. And then later on, of course, we moved round the corner. You see, the people who owned these three houses were called Pace, and they lived at Bradford. And so what happened was, of course, this house we went and lived in, this little cottage, my great aunt lived in it, you see. I'll get a photograph of her here, I'll show you after. And of course, that's how we had somewhere to live, of course. And of course, later on, of course, his mother died in that little tiny cottage, of course. And then later on, some people who lived round the corner in Yew Tree Cottage, she wrote to them, asked them if we could move into there. And of course, they said they were in, all right, they said it was okay for us to go there. So we moved into that one. See, it was the same landlords, of course.
That's Yew Tree Cottage in Barngarth, is it?
So this, yes, that one's in Barngarth. And right opposite was an old barn, a really old barn. There was no spouts or anything, and the water used to pour off. And just used to use it to put stuff for the show and things like that in it, to store in it, you see.
Which show would that be?
The Cartmel Show.
The Cartmel Show?
Yeah, because they had various bands that would put stuff in, you see. And of course, years later, of course, that was on one after we left. It was all pulled down, knocked down. And then later on, actually in that house, a man called Dickinson, and I don't know if he was a theology professor or something connected with either at Cambridge or Oxford, it was one of them, but he wrote a book all on Cartmel as well. And he eventually moved into that house years and years and years later, of course. And then he had a piece built on the end of it, I think, for his library, I think. But of course, he's all dead and gone now, of course. But then after that, of course, we moved into the corner house, which is called Hazel Dean, which was a big house. And I remember the rent for that house was £1 a week.
And who was the landlord of that house?
Pacey, some people from Bradford. And she used to go to the bank in the square, because there was three. There was Martin's Bank, and there was the Midland Bank, I think it was, or the District Bank. I can't remember which it was. And she used to go once a month to pay the money into there, you see, for the rent. That's how they got their money, of course.
So when you moved, Bob, you were about seven.
Yes.
You must have been going to school then.
Oh yes, I was going to school. Yeah, yeah.
What can you remember about the school?
Well, the school. I remember quite a lot of things about the school. When I first went there, I know all the floorboards were all big knots sticking up out of the boards. And you used to trip over them, that's how awkward they were. And then must have been the second summer as we were there, when it was the summer holidays, they ripped the whole lot out and put all new floorboards in and that.
And just to be clear, where was the school in those days?
Just around the corner, where it is now.
So the primary school?
The primary school, right. Yes.
Okay.
You see, all I did was come along Barngarth and up the lane,
yes,
to the school, or down Ainsham Road.
So what was the school day like for you?
Well, it was all right. And the playground, of course, didn't belong to the school. It was a Jubilee. It says it on the post there, Jubilee Playground. It was for some Jubilee, you see. That the village must have bought it for that, you see. And the only thing about it was all pinel. And when you went in there, especially it was a wet day, and of course we all wore clogs, and some, of course, and when you came back out, it used to, you know what, when snow's on the ground, how it sticks to the bottom of you? She goes, well, with clogs, it's like that, it sticks to the bottom. And this stuff used to stick to the bottom of our clogs. And it used to look as if some builders had, all the mark across the road looks as if some building site had been. And we, just outside, they're still there, the scrapers to scrape our boots. They're still by that door there, right, those scrapers.
By the back door of the
By the door where you go in the school.
Bob, what are clogs?
Clogs are you either buy them and they're all leather, or if you've had an old pair of boots, you can have them, they're made of wood. They're made of wood, the soles, you see. And of course, the difference between when you bought them brand new with leather tops as well, the only thing was they were very, very hard. And they used to chafe you around your ankle until they got soft. So if you had an old pair of boots of ordinary leather, you see, they were soft. And if you took them to the cobbler's, which was in Cavendish Street, a man called Waring, they would put those soft tops onto a wooden clogged sole, you see, and they've got corkers underneath. There's a corker underneath, but the heel and all round the toe, you see. And of course, they were a lot nicer for your ankles, they were. Anyway, so that was at school, and I always remember things about school. The teacher, we'd been seven, I didn't go in the infant class. I'd started school at Gainsborough just 1 year, because I remember coming home with a paper for me granny, and I said, you've got to sign this paper, granny, for, I said, I've got to take it back to school for us to be inoculated. It wasn't inoculated, it was for that cow business you get, you know, where they scrape the skin, don't they?
Yes.
So they call it cowpox, I think, is one of the, yes, they put on, and then it leaves a mark on your arm. And I always remember, she said, you're not having it done. I said, she was quite adamant about this. And so I said, I've got to take this paper back. And she threw the paper away. I don't want you to put it in the fire or something. And I went up the wall about this, of course, because I had to take it back to school. Because, I mean, you used to think the people at school were like gods, weren't they? Teachers at school.
So what happened when you couldn't produce
and
the paper?
And the reason why she didn't have it, it seemed she'd had half her family done with this inoculation and the other half not. And the ones that had not been done didn't seem to get as many calls one than another as the ones that did. That was their what she was thinking. Okay. So that's why she didn't get me done.
But were you in trouble at school?
Oh, I suppose so. And people said, well, couldn't help the granny, you know, disposing of the phone.
So you didn't have it done?
So I didn't have it done. Anyway.
So just tell us a little bit about a day at school.
Well, I remember after I'd been there about maybe 18 months or more, a new teacher came, who was called Miss Weekly, and she was only a young person, about 23 or 4. And she was a real smasher because she really had her heart, some of this. And she used to take us out for nature walks, that's why we liked her, and up the lanes and going towards Wellnow and places like that, you know, and pointing out hedgerows and flowers that grow in the hedgerows and trees and things. I mean, it was all interesting, which was really good to us. And we thought she was smashing Miss Weekly, because I didn't like Miss Owen because she used to teach history. And Miss Simpson, well, it seems her dad had been the schoolmaster there, and he taught, I always called him Pop, me stepfather. I couldn't bring myself to call him Dad, I always called him Pop. Him and his sisters, the doll, he'd been the schoolmaster when they were there, and I believe he was a really strict man, he was. And so she was in the Standard 1 class, and I always remember in the singing lesson, I said, and her throat used to go, and her face used to go all red, and you know. And then Miss Weekly, of course, came, we moved into her class. She was nice. But the only thing I remember about the actual going into the top class was the headmaster. He used to come into school at 9 o'clock. And he used to be at his desk, and all the teachers used to take the register of each of the class. they would come through and hand the things to him, all the register for each class, and then he used to put them under his arm and he'd walk out. And who should walk in but his wife? He absolutely flatly refused to teach religious education. And I think it was because he'd been in the 1914-18 war, and he must have thought himself, well, if that's religion, I want nothing to do with it. That, I think that how he got the job, I don't know, because it was a Church of England school.
Yes.
It was. So, I mean, how he got the job, I don't know. They must have been desperate. But there's only one thing I always remember about that school. Later on, as I got older, I was a sort of a monitor, and we were living near the school. I had to be there for 9 o'clock, before 9 o'clock, 5 to 9 or 10 to 9, to ring the bell. There was a bell, you see, there, and you just have to ring the bell at 9 o'clock, you see. And, of course, I thought that was a real big do, but there's only one thing I remember about that. I always remember when he was picking people out to sit an exam for the grammar school. And the grammar school, which is gone now, was a really impressive building as well at Ulverston Victoria Grammar School. And what happened was, he picked different lads out who their fathers were sort of semi-well-off sort of business, you see. And the reason for that was that if they failed their exam, which they were sitting, they could still go with what you call an entrance exam. But they had to pay for the books and the different things like that, you see. If you went in by your ability and your brains, of course, you got all that free.
Yeah.
You see, so instead of giving, say, some lads whose dads... Now, I remember one lad whose dad was a bus washer. He used to wash the buses, and he never ever saw him only at night time going to work, coming back in the morning. Now, he was really brainy, that lad, Miley Barnes, and different ones. Now, some farmer's sons, they went, you see, because they were quite well. Now, five of us lads used to knock about together, and one of them was called Philip Howarth, and his dad was the local rate collector, and he had a car. And the only car in the village was his. It was a little Morris Minor, and also Unsworth, who had a taxi. So that was the only two cars in the village.
Which Unsworth would that have been?
Unsworth's there now.
But which one?
Oh, he's an uncle to all this lot, you know, and granddad and one another.
Right.
And so what happened was, his dad had been in the 1948, and he'd been an officer, you see. And so, of course, he picked him. And I remember Roddy Burns. Now, his dad was a painter. Well, he didn't pick him, but he used to sit in the same desk as him. And half the time, he was like this in the desk asleep. I can remember him shouting at him, "Burns, waken Howarth up," he used to shout, you see. And yet he went to grammar school.
So where was the grammar school?
At Ulverston.
At Ulverston, okay. Yeah. And after you finished at the primary school, did you
14
go
went
to
out to. We went out to work. 14. But you went to grammar school, you went to year 16.
So when you finished at the primary school, you were 14 years old?
Yeah.
So after finishing at the primary school, did most people go to work?
Of course they did, yeah.
So the old grammar school that we call it now,
yeah.
This is... opposite the race course.
No, not that grammar school. That's nothing to do with it. No, that was.
But
never...
was that a school at that
it
time?
It was a school. It was called a grammar school because it had been a grammar school years and years ago, and they split it in half, and half of it was for girls to go for domestic science, how to wash a thing and iron a thing and all the rest of it, and the other half was for boys, and we learnt joinery in the afternoon. In the morning we had gardening because there was a field by it. And we all had little plots. And so we had gardening in the morning and joinery in the afternoon.
So you did go to that school?
Yes.
And how old would you have been?
Well, you had to be, I think it was either 10 or 11 when you went there, you see. And of course, Allithwaite and Lindale and Grange, they all went there. They all had to go there on different days. They all had their different days.
How many boys and girls were in the school, Bob, about?
Oh, I can tell you. With one of that book in there, I can tell you later on about that, how many that was.
Okay.
In that book, it gives the number of people in each school. It even tells you how many cockles have been in the caught in the bay and everything there in that book in there.
Bob, You said the headmaster picked the children who were to go on to grammar school.
Because the parents, you see, it was sort of a standard they were living up to, you see. Now, when they met, and especially on sports days, all little schools used to meet sports days, some at Cartmel on the park, some at Hawker Park, and Lindale, they didn't have anywhere to go. And that where they just built all that new place at Grange here, the car park, which is a what is it, centre now, isn't it, for the doctors? Well, that was a field then. That was where Grange had their sports. All the sports, you see, for each school, combined schools, you see, had the sport. And they used to talk. And of course, little pigs have big ears. And I remember standing near them one day. I don't know whether it was at Cartmel or whether it was at Grange. And they were discussing all the different things. Was the headmaster from Lindale and the one from Cartmel and the one from Grange, his name was Cash, and one from Holker, he used to wear a gown at school, he did. Oh, he was a horrible thing, he was, that fella. But they were discussing how many pupils that had gone to grammar school, and it was sort of a standard, you see. Oh, well, I had 6 go or I had 7 go, but they hadn't got there by their ability, they got there by on the entrance exam, but they'd gone, and he thought it was a standard for each school, how many had gone there, you see. That was the way of thinking, you see.
What age were the pupils when they finished education at the grammar school?
16.
16?
Yeah.
So were you 16 when you left?
No, 14.
So you left from the
primary school? I never got grammar school. My dad was only you see, like I said, when he was out of work when I first came to Cartmel. And what happened was, a big firm from London came up and they got the contract to bring an electric line across from Ulverston and across the Ulverston Viaduct, right across that there, over that hill there, across the Moss, over Halborough, down Cartmel Valley, up over Hampsfell, right through to Meathop. Well, that was a TB home for men and women, you see. And they had their own plant there, of course, but they wanted power. More power, you see. And so that's why Cartmel actually got electricity. That was when Cartmel got electric. We used to have oil lamps when I first got there. Just on those, everything was in darkness.
How old were you at then, Bob?
I was 7.
7?
Yeah.
And you were born, you said, in 1919.
Yeah.
So that would have been in 1926.
Yeah.
When electricity came to the village for the first time.
I remember it coming over. See, now, if you look in that valley, there isn't any because these people that do for the countryside and wonder the welfare, they managed to get them buried the lines in lots of it. Over Amersfield, there's no post going over Amersfield or anywhere like that because they buried it all. You see, because you can see it in again the skyline. You see, they've done all those things since. But as you say, and so he got a job for this firm, and believe it or not, do you know what kind of lorries they had? I can still remember. You've heard of Henry Ford and his Ford T cars. Well, they were Ford T lorries,
and
they would just carry 2 poles. But they must have been strong little lorries, though. Do you know? Because all down in Cartmel Valley, of course, they were. But I remember where that road goes up to the Hampsfell from here, from this. They went up that road and up the fell. They even went up the fell, on the fell side, some of those. And all he had on was 2. Mind you, they were massive things. Those, they were a lot bigger than telephone poles. You know? They were, I think it was, 3,000 or 6,000 volts, something like that. It was a tremendous amount of power was going through them at the time.
Okay.
But they weren't like these metal ones you see now, these big ones, you know.
Bob, tell us a bit about...
And that's where he got the job, of course. And of course, he managed to. I have a photograph of him, still in his ordinary civvies, and he's with the other postman about to go out on the rounds. And he stood there. And he hadn't even got his uniform, and he got a job in the post office. And of course, he was on that until he finished.
So tell us a bit about what happened after you finished at school. You were 14. So what did you do?
Well, I got a job. I went up to Beckside to a man called Hornby, a farmer. And No. The first job I got was at Ansom Labs, behind where you are. There was Ansom Labs there, laboratories. Now then, what we did there, we boiled oil. There were big flakes of candle wax, and we had to put this in this big cauldron, which was on wheels, and we had a big fire lit underneath, of course, and white spirit, and then and also big barrels of Vaseline, what you call petroleum jelly, you know. And there were so many, it was all weighed, you had to weigh it up and put it in. And then you roll it over all this fire, and there was a thermometer going in it, and it had to be brought to a boil for so many hours, you see, until it was all liquefied. But if you ever sneezed anywhere near it, which you found out, I mean, it used to go boom, 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 it used to go scared as a stiff, it did, you know. And then after it had cooled down, because we used to do it in the light of fire the next day, maybe 48 hours, I don't know, we used to, it was all cooled down, we used to be put into 44-gallon drums, and it was going to the Admiralty at Liverpool. And it was for oils to do on oil skins. That's what it was for. Now then, some of the jobs they did was, I always remember one of the jobs he gave, and there was always wheat from came from all over the world. That wheat used to come there in small bags, and it was all tested and one another, and then later on it was made into a bread, and of course then it sent back to the people who'd sent the wheat. You see, the process was all about. I know his man name was Horton. He later had the pub with the King's Arms at Cartmel later on.
Sorry, Bob, I'm not clear why they did that. They sent the wheat.
They sent the wheat to be tested, you see, and all the different process it went through, you see. And then it was made into a bread and that, and of course the local, the people who were in charge used to take the bread home, of course, you see. But another job they did was, the top lab were just testing, because we should make our own. Every morning when we got there, a man came from Lancaster, who was an engineer, and there was a big Lister engine in the shed there. And I used to have to be there. There was another lad, there's two of us doing this oil job. I used to have to help him to twine this Lister engine up because the compression on it was tremendous. And then that used to make the power for the whole of the place, you see. And then also, there was another thing we had to do. They used to make their own gas. It was on the outside. It went right away up above the roof, this all boxed in. And we used to have to wind these weights up, like a clock, in other words. And then as it came down, of course, gradually, it must have mixed something to make it into a gas for the Budson burners in the top lab, as we called it. But one of the jobs, I remember, what was that? Anyway, what happened was, they had little copper ovens.
Yeah.
And they gave me this copper oven, and they said, right, go around in the sandpit and take this copper oven, and also there was some caustic soda that used to get in these small barrels and used to make their own, and it was so potential, you know, well, so sort of strong that it used to make a white crust around the when water was added to it, you see. And so they made me get a stick and put some string round it, a piece of cloth, and dip the sand and dip it in this caustic and rub this copper oven to get it, bring it all bright. And I always remember, and they didn't give you any gloves or anything like that. I mean, you think about it, this day and age. And when I went over, and my fingernails were all going yellow, they were, you know. And I thought, I'm going to lose my damn nails at this job, you know. Anyway, but one of the jobs that I always remember, and that's why I got the hell out of it, there was caustic soda, what do you call that stuff? It's black stuff, and it'll burn any mortal thing on this earth by water and glass.
It's black?
It's black, and it's in great big boys, those big boys. Well, I'll tell you what happened was, it's like a caustic kind of stuff it is. Anyway, it even burned metal. If you put it on anything, it'll burn it. This particular day, the top lab wanted a dozen bottles of this, and there were bottles about that high. We had a glass funnel, and the engineer and I got this buoy, and we put it on, it was on like a cradle, but there was a handle as well, and it was sort of on a rocking system, you see. And of course, and he had a bucket of water there at the side of us in case he should splash on you. And of course, he was doing his secrets. And I was at this side holding this glass funnel and into this glass jar. And we'd done about five or six bottles or something like that. And then all of a sudden, it slipped. And some went on the ground. And it bubbled and bubbled and all the ground went. Was it all? And soon splashed onto me, all onto me overalls and me boots. I didn't stop for that bucket of water. You know what I did? I went running across that yard and jumped straight in that bloody beck. Behind you, there's a beck, isn't there?
There is.
That's where I jumped into and threw the water all onto myself. A damn good job I did.
And when did it do you any damage?
When I went home and had my lunch or my dinner out in Cartmel, all the places had splashed on me, went all brown and it just fell away like powder. And my boots as well, all was ruined. Where?
How long did you work there for?
I soon got the hell out of that job, I'll tell you. I wasn't there very long.
Do you remember how much you were being paid?
10 shillings a week. Yeah, 50p.
How many people were there?
Oh, there was a lot of people. A lot of people worked there, yeah. Yeah, a lot of people.
Who owned the labs?
A man called Ward. And he had a mistress, one of his lady friends was in there, and we were told never ever to go to his office unless we knocked and were told to come in, because he was canoodling with his lady friend, he was. And that lady friend, believe it or not, he set her up in business. And he went to Northern Ireland, set up a laboratory in Northern Ireland, and he set her up as the boss there. Never ever saw her again.
But while we're out at Ainsa, were the laboratories the only business that was there?
Yes. Yes.
So all of those buildings...
Oh, all those buildings have gone. They've gone. There's nothing at all there now. Just the main building itself. There was buildings galore all the way around. There was even an orchard that was over towards the wall.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you didn't stay there for too long. What was the next
job? And then I got a job... a man, he used to come round Cartmel called Hornby, and he used to come round his house in Cartmel on a Saturday morning selling potatoes and carrots and boiling fowls and chickens, you see. And so, seeing I made myself redundant, or not redundant, I made myself out of work, so my mum said to him, is there any chance of getting a job at the farm? And so he said, oh, I'll have him, he said. You can come and work with me, he said.
Which farm was it, Bob?
That's on Beckside Way, that farm where that goes right through the farmyard.
Yeah.
Before you go up that little steep hill.
Yeah, okay.
I think somebody called Wilson lives there now. Anyway, so I went, and he used to grow sprouts and potatoes and all the rest of it. And I always remember when the sprouts were... Because when the sprouts are growing, you see, they sort of hold the water with the rain and that. You see, and so you have to put sacks around you from here with string, binder twine as they call it, and paper or anything like that. Because as you're going through picking these sprouts, you see, of course you're getting all wet, you see, if you didn't have that on. And then
you protected your legs.
Yes, protect your legs. And so, and then of course it was time to get the potatoes up, of course. You see, well, all the tops had all broke off. All died away, and so they have what you call a plough, which goes down the centre of the furrow, and it opens it up like that, you see. And of course they didn't have tractors in those days, it was just horse and cart, and they had what you call swills. They are made, you know what a swill is, don't you? Made out of swills, they all had swills, and you just started picking the potatoes, see, and throwing them in the swills, and the horse and cart was there, and you walked to and put it in, and then the horse and cart moved further along like that. And of course, it's a really back-breaking job, is picking potatoes. And I was only just turned 14, as I say. And I was living there. Of course, my wage was 10 shillings a week, because I wasn't improving my wages.
You were living on the farm?
On the farm, yeah. Yeah.
So even though you lived...
At Cartmel, I was living in the farm. Because I used to get up in the morning, and of course there wasn't milking machines, it was all done by hand. Well, he hadn't got around to the business of learning to milk. All my job was shoveling all the shit into a barrel and barring it outside, you see. And of course that's what, and by that time his wife had got up at 7 o'clock, because he used to get up at about 5:30, something like that, and doing the milking. And
so he was doing the milking by hand?
Yes, the boss and his son, you see, two sons there was. And so what happened was, and I always remember, when you went in for your breakfast, you didn't sit with the boss. He sat at a little round table near the fire with his wife. The two sons sat over by the window, you see, and I sat there with them. And we got porridge, of course. And of course, I hadn't been used to eating porridge because it was that red hot, you know. And the bacon, of course, was all bacon. It was a pig that killed and then cured it, of course. And it was all hanging on the ceiling. They just could take it down and just slice it off as they wanted. Well, it was all fat, and maybe a thin streak of lean going through the middle, but the rest of it was fat. And of course, that was it. Well, by the time I'd got through my porridge, these lads had already got through theirs. They're that used to it, their sons, and they were on with the bacon, you see. And he said, "Nay, they must eat a lot quicker than that. They'll never get outside in time." He said, "They doesn't get yourself. Get the porridge down," he said. And anyway, things happen like that. And so anyway, I always remember going out to the field and picking spuds. And I don't know, it was a second day or third day we were doing it. And I know, back was that way, that instead of picking like this with two hands, the potatoes, I went and leaned on one like that and was just picking with one hand. And he was ahead of me, and he turned round and saw me. And he said, "Nay, there's no turning thee bloody grub," he said, "picking with your hand," he said, "with one hand, you see." And I was so chock-a-block to this, right up to where I was. And so I just stood up, I said, "Well, for what your grub is, Mr. Ormby, you can ruddy well stick it." And I just walked off the field and walked out, got me bike and went home. I thought, right, you've had that, mate.
How long had you been there? Was it
only about 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay.
And so then I got a job as a butcher's boy at Proctor's at Grange. Well, of course, every Monday morning, the lad who used to do the slaughtering, called Shepherd, he had a motorbike, and I used to get on the back, and we used to share a slaughterhouse at Allithwaite. Well, it was a right carry on, that was. And of course, used to get the cattle in the shuppen where the cattle that was for slaughtering was at the end of the house, and he used to go in and put the rope around the cow's head, you see, and I'd have all the end of the rope, and he used to sort of come along this rope, and then there was the end of a wall, and so after he got it out of there, he would sort of run up the wall, up the yard, and he would get it, the end of it, round there, because he was a really strong lad, he was, you see, the butcher. A big fat lad he was, but he was really strong. And then I used to get the end and thread it, go into the slaughterhouse and thread it through a ring in the floor, you see. And then, of course, he gradually used to pull it round and get it in. And of course, you get his head right way down there, see, on the floor, and all it can do is this, you see. Well, of course, in days gone by, they used to use what you call a poleaxe. Well, that was an axe's head on one side, and on the other side it was just a point like that, you see. Well, imagine apprentices and that trying to kill things that were swinging it around and going. I mean, when you think of the way animals were being treated in those days, it was terrible. Well, of course, Georgie was worried. And so on the way there sometimes, on the back of the motorbike, he sometimes used to see a man walking down the road. It was somebody he knew who had hound dogs. And of course, he used to shout to him, "It's the guy down to kill." He says, "Aye." He said, "I'll be down then," he said. So George would say, "Aye." He said, "Give us 15 minutes, he said, and be down." And so when he knew this lad was going to come, this fellow was going to come down, it was to get the head of it, you see. So I only saw him do it either once or else twice. I think it was only once. He got the poleaxe, And of course, I say, it was a really good manager job, straight in the middle of its ruddy head. That was it, you know, dead. But and of course, the idea was, you see, if an inspector had come round, he'd have been up the wall about that, you see, because he'd have looked straight away to see how he'd have been killed, you see, and he'd have been in dead trouble. But and he knew this fellow was coming down for the head, because all he used to do was cut it off, cut all the cheeks off it, and cut the tongue out of it, and put it in a bag, and of course this bloke would come down and take it away.
So what was the correct method of killing?
Well, I'm telling you, get round that. So then they brought out what you call a cash captive pistol, and it was like quite a heavy thing. It was cash captive pistol. Now then, you broke it in the top like that, and you put a cap in it, just a small cap like that, and they had different ones for different animals, different powers regards the to make it go. And there was a bolt inside of it, you see, and all you did was you put it there, snapped it to, and you put it by the cow's head, and you pull the trigger, and that bolt just shot into its head. I mean, you couldn't miss, could you? Let's face it. See, even when it went like that, you see. But before that, though, I'm getting in front of things. Before that, after the poleaxe, was called what you call the bell gun. It was like a round thing like that, and it was made of copper, and then a stem like that, and you screwed the top off, and you put a bullet in it, a proper bullet. And on the bottom of the thing itself, it was a hole, of course. And the bottom of it was sloped, not flat, it was sloping like that. And you put that on its head, like that, and you just tap the top of it with the back end of a knife or anything, and the bullet shot straight out into its head. Well, the only thing about that was that just as you did that, suppose you had two apprentices, and just as you did it, the cow moved its head, where's the bullet going to go? It's going to hit the floor and go all over the place, isn't it? You see, so it was really dangerous when you think about it. So that's when they brought out the cash captive pistol. Nothing came out of it, only it just drove a bolt, that's all. Right. And you did that, and they still use that today.
And that was approved by the Ministry of Agriculture,
was it? Well, the bell gun was, it would come to that. It was just an improvement on it, you see.
Right.
But what was the annoying thing about it all was, after you'd killed it, you see, you ought to stand away from it, because all the nerves of an animal is like that all for about 5 minutes, you know. You'll get kicked to death if you don't. Even though it's dead, its nerves are going like that. You see, its back legs and its front legs. But what the most annoying part about it was, down there, they had, you see, all bungalows and houses where there isn't sewerage, they have what you call a cesspool, don't they, for stuff to go in. And maybe once a year or something like that, they have to have these wagons come and suck it all out, don't they? Well, it was a cesspool there. So therefore, we couldn't allow the blood to go into the cesspool. So all we had to do was bung the hole up with an old cloth. And then, of course, as you slit its throat, you see, when it's dead, of course, all the blood had all over the floor. You had to let it all congeal and then shovel it all up into buckets and carry it out and put it in the ruddy field. I mean, what a carry-on that was, you see.
That was done to avoid the blood going into the cesspool.
Yeah, you couldn't let it go in the cesspool. No way.
Why not?
Well, I mean, it's going to cause. I mean, look at the work it would cause. I mean, it would go over the smell from it, and God knows what would be terrific, wouldn't it? I mean, it's not going to be emptied for maybe ages, is it? And you see,
the cesspools didn't smell very nice.
Anyway,
already,
no. But you see, now someone bought, you see, Asplin's here at Grange there, because they were by the mains. They had a little field next to it, they could bring them out. And then, of course, when they killed them, they just had the hose pipe on, you see, and it all went away sort of diluted with the water and that, didn't it? Mm-hmm. See, they didn't have all that bother with us.
Okay, so come back to the butchers now. Your job was as the butcher's boy, wasn't it?
Going out with meat.
So you were delivering the meat?
Delivering meat, and he was so miserable and tight, he wouldn't even wrap things up. He used to have a big roll of, a big lot of paper, greaseproof paper on the counter, and you would tear it up into sections and that. Instead of putting the thing on and wrapping it up and saying, right, you know, I mean, well, he did do for customers that came in for things, like a pound of sausages or anything like that. But you see, we're delivering stuff, you just used to get a piece of paper like that. They're about that size. And you clap it on there and write the person's name on the corner. And it went into my basket like that. Maybe about four or five or six things. Well, sometimes the blood and God knows what, you could hardly make out what it was. You see, it had gone over it. But I always remember one lady, a Mrs. Robinson, used to ring down. Her husband used to drive a Daimler for Grange Motors. I think he used to keep it purposely for them. And he used to say, oh, Sharps. You know, you've heard of Sharps, it's toffee, haven't you? Well, they lived at Kent's Bank, and they had a permanent what is it with Proctor's audit, see, and they never paid at all, not maybe for 12 months or even longer than that. Of course, I remember him grumbling. He said, "I wish those so and so would pay their ruddy bills." He used to say, you know, there. But I mean, he got his money in the end. I mean, let's face it; it was always guaranteed. I mean, they weren't as if they were bankrupt. Sharps toffee.
So, would the customers have given the order the day before?
No. He used to ring up. You see.
Oh, they used to ring up.
You know, yeah, and I remember, and so he used to say, "Sharps have rung up." And so he used to take his overall boiler suit off and put his, cap on and go out and drive them round Grange. I can remember they had one daughter and she was dressed like some old Victorian lass she was, with pale blue, was it, and a round hat on and a veil on. I mean, this is a young lass of about 12, you know. And then see a big Daimler car. I can remember seeing her around with a big soft bitch, you know. Oh, okay. Dear.
Where was the butcher's in those
days? And the one about this Mrs. Robinson, she used to ring up, you see, he used to go home for his lunch. She'd ring up at maybe about 10 to 12 and he used to go home for his meal. And she used to ring up and say, George, and especially on a Wednesday when he used to go around with a van travelling, did proctor himself. And she said, will you send us up a couple of, half a pound of sliced liver, she said, and a couple of kidneys. She said, can you get up here for 12? She said, and he lived at the top of the Grange Fell. Oh, flippy neck, I mean, that was a really, wanted to get up there, and then she had the cookies by the time he got home, just after 12 he did. Those kind of customers used to make me mad, they did. And one day, I got my bike, and it was on this particular errand, and Proctor was off away, and I was just with George, the butcher, and me in the shop. And she rung up, and so I said, George said, wrap it up, and said, you know, so he did do to please me. And they put it in the basket, and away I went up Laundry Hill, and then I just stood on the pedal, because down Fernley Road, and then there's another road goes up called that's going up onto Highfield Road, that road. Well, that road was all rough cobbles. It hadn't been done with tarmac and everything. It was really rough, that road, and so instead of sort of cocking my leg over on the shop bike, I just stood on the pedal, and I went round that corner, just like that, putting the brakes on, of course, and what do you think happened? I just got round that corner, and a firm from Lindale called Birch's had just got the contract to do that road up to tarmac it all, and of course to level it up. And they had the wagon going up there, lorry, dragging 1 ton 10 hand roller with a chain round the handle fastened to the back, and it had broke loose. And they got halfway up and it was coming careering down that hill, and I just come round that corner. What do you think it did? It just caught the corner of my bike as I dropped off, caught the carrier part of it and bent it like that, straight across the road, through the wall, hit the house, all the pictures in the house dropped off the wall. You can tell what it had hit me, I'd have been a dead man. What? Yeah, that, I remember that.
That was a narrow escape.
Absolutely, not kidding, it was. And when he used to go travelling, you see, he used to pick up rabbits at Meathup.
Yeah.
And he also used to pick up live hens in a sack. So that when he came back, of course, because he used to, in those days, they could hang stuff outside, you see. They weren't allowed to do anything like that this day and age. It was right, even game merchants and that, they were allowed to hang pheasants and everything outside, hares and God knows what. Where Grange now is, that used to be a game shop there.
Bob, we've been going for the best part of an hour. Can we just have a little break for a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
We'll just stop it. And I think